afternoon, everyone. The Senate Committee on Agriculture and Rural Economies will now come to order. Today's business will finish the, hopefully we'll finish the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's overview and then get on to Dr. Bill Hartman with the Board of Animal Health. So, Ms. Cheney, we're ready for you. Or Dr. Kassenberg, whoever's...
Mr. Chair, I'm Quinn Cheney with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm the policy director there, and last week I presented the non-regulatory divisions at the Department of Ag for you. Those were the divisions that were involved in promotion of our agricultural products in Minnesota and providing consulting and services to our growers and producers. Today we're going to talk about the regulatory divisions at the MDA. That's the Dairy and Food Inspection Division, the Plant Protection Division, Pesticide and Fertilizer Management, and Laboratory Services. And I guess I just wanted to highlight one component of our mission as, in a second, Dr. Heidi Kassenberg will talk about our Dairy and Food Inspection Division. And part of MDA's mission is really geared towards that division, ensuring the integrity of our food supply. And when Geir Friso with the Plant Protection Division and Greg Vizicki with the Pesticide and Fertilizer Inspection Division come up, their focus is really more the health of our environment. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Heidi Kassenberg.
Welcome, Dr. Kassenberg. Please announce yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Dr. Heidi Kassenberg. I'm the division director of the Dairy and Food Inspection Division at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. How we are organized within our division, programmatically we've got our food program, our dairy program, our meat and egg and poultry program, and then also our feed inspection program. And that's how we divide the labor of what we do. Oftentimes we get asked the question, well, where does your authority start, where does it end, and where does the Department of Health's authority start? So this schematic and also our other agency that we share the Orville Freeman Building with, our Board of Animal Health. So this schematic shows kind of the divisions statutorily. The Board of Animal Health, of course, has jurisdiction over live animal diseases primarily. So that's what they deal with. For the Department of Agriculture, in our division, we have statutory authority over feed production, food production facilities, dairy farms, dairy processing, transportation, all the way up to grocery stores. And that's what we call retail establishments. At that point, if you consider it kind of the plate, when the food comes in that whole farm-to-table continuum, at the plate level, then it gets handed off to the Department of Health. And they delegate a considerable number of their authorities to local jurisdictions. And they also are responsible for foodborne illness surveillance. And once they detect an abnormality in foodborne illness cases, then we get involved with tracing the product back and also doing investigations at the production level. So why do we inspect? What's the point, really? Why is this important for the taxpayer, and why is it important for food production businesses? Well, our job as an inspector, as an inspection agency, is to ensure that in a food production facility, they have the processes in place to produce food. No longer are we looking just at floors, walls, and ceilings so that it looks clean. We're actually looking at the production, the system, if you will, of food production. And oftentimes this is, unfortunately, it's the employees and firms' only real exposure to food safety is our food inspector. And so we do a lot of education, and that's really our main point when our inspectors go to those facilities is to educate and then get the people into compliance. And so what happens if we didn't do these types of inspections? Well, it could increase the numbers of foodborne illnesses and the numbers of outbreaks. And that's not good, obviously, for the people affected, but it's also not good for the product that caused the illness. We've seen that with the peanut butter outbreak a few years ago, where it wasn't just that one brand of peanut butter, it was all peanut butter. Sales went down. And then when there was the tomato situation where there was first thought to be a tomato outbreak, but it turned out to be a jalapeno outbreak, all of the tomato industry suffered. So when these things occur, the consumer confidence level decreases, and it can have economic effects as well. So some of the activities that our programs do are feed inspection. What they do is they do inspections to ensure that prohibited mammalian protein doesn't show up in feed. And that, of course, that's the stuff that caused the BSE outbreak. It's important to note, and sometimes you wonder, why is feed within the Dairy and Food Inspection Division? Well, the feed that the animals eat will someday be consumed by humans. And then we also look at the general feed manufacturers and distributors. But then we ensure that the medicated feed manufacturers have the proper controls in place so that we don't wind up with a lot of antibiotic residues. We also do tissue residue tracebacks, meaning if there's antibiotic residues that are found in at the slaughter plants, we do the tracebacks back to the farm in question. And then we also have some roles with rendering. Within our dairy program, we've got over 4,000 what we call grade A farms that we inspect, and we inspect those twice a year. Grade A farms are the fluid milk farms, so those are the milk you get at the grocery store. And then we also have a few over 400 manufacturing grade farms, and those are inspected once a year. And those are, that milk primarily goes for cheese, some other products, some dried products as well. We also inspect all the plants that are in Minnesota that produce milk, cheese, yogurt, ice cream. And so those are inspected quarterly. And one of the main things that they do is they test the pasteurizers. The pasteurizers are the piece of fairly complicated equipment that heats the milk to a certain temperature to ensure that it kills any of the bad bacteria in the milk. And so we do a lot of those, because a lot of facilities have several pasteurizers within their plant. And it's important that we do, that our inspection program is such that it meets FDA standards. Otherwise, if we would fall below those standards, we wouldn't be allowed to sell milk across state lines. We also are considered what the phrase equal to for meat, for our meat program. Equal to means equal to the USDA Food Safety Inspection Service standards. And what that enables us to do is to sell meat products, or a producer can sell meat products within the state if it's inspected by a Minnesota inspector. It cannot be sold out of the state, however. So most of the meat that you get in the grocery store is probably USDA inspected. The Federal Meat Inspection Act is a pretty powerful, has a lot of authority, and so that regulates meat products pretty much. So the states don't have a whole lot of role in meat, but they do have some role if they're considered equal to, and they have to maintain standards in order to become and maintain their equal to program. That's can be a fairly logistical challenge because the plants are scattered throughout Minnesota, and if a particular firm is slaughtering on a particular day, they have to be there all day. And so that can be a bit of a logistical challenge. We do about 2,000 days of slaughter inspection a year, and we also do processing inspections where not it's the stuff that's post-slaughter. We also have what we call custom-exempt facilities, and those facilities are commonly known as locker plants. It's where a person can bring their own animal in and have it processed for their own use or they're non-paying guests. And so this this particular product is not inspected when it's slaughtered. Our role is to ensure that cleanliness and sanitation of the facility. It's not to actually supervise the slaughter and processing of that. This particular product would be marked not for sale, meaning it can't be sold to others because there's no inspection involved in it. And we have 250 facilities. Those are inspected quarterly, and we've done 1,000 inspections over the year. Then our food protection program. It's important to note that the majority of food facility inspections are done at the state level, and that includes Minnesota. FDA has a role in some of those inspections, but in large part, they contract with states to conduct those inspections, particularly of food manufacturer facilities. They have almost no role in retail facilities, and by retail, I mean grocery stores. So we've got about over 4,000 retail facilities that we inspect, and 1,300 food manufacturers and processors.
Dr. Kaisenbrink, we have a question. Senator Kubley?
Yeah, I think of it, Sharon, Dr. Kaisenberg. When you say that the locker plants are not inspected, are there plants where the people that market directly to the consumer go to that are inspected? Is that right? Or do they go to a local locker?
Senator Kaisenberg? Heidi?
Mr. Chair? Committee members? If a person wants to buy an animal, and, you know, this happens fairly frequently where a producer has, you know, a herd of cattle, and you can contact them and buy the animal, and then that particular producer takes it to the locker plant. It all has to do with where the sale takes place. It has to be done while the animal is alive. So that's the key point on that. Now, if they want to take that, you know, the packaged product, the product that went after it's been slaughtered and cut up, and sell that to different people, then they're going to have that done at a special facility, a facility where the whole process is inspected. But the key point is where that transaction takes place. And if it's at the live animal part, then they can go to a custom slaughter facility. And then, of course, we've been involved in quite a few national outbreaks, anywhere from the jalapeno pepper tomato outbreak to the peanut butter outbreak. And this, the peanut butter outbreak really illustrated the importance of our laboratory. Our laboratory was able to isolate the pathogen, a particular type of salmonella, in a 5-gallon pail of peanut butter, which is no easy trick. When you look, it's really like looking for a needle in a haystack. So we've been involved in a lot of those, and we also obviously collaborate with our other agency that has food safety responsibilities, our Department of Health. In our budget, this outlines our budget, which is pretty straightforward. We have 111 FTEs. A majority of those live in greater Minnesota, or actually they live in their inspection territory. So it's actually a requirement if they're going to be an employee and a particular territory opens up that they live in that area.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Ms.
I'll just highlight my typo on this. The total biennial base budget is not $10.56 million. That is the general fund contribution for this division. So I just didn't add it all up, but the numbers in the legend for this pie graph accurately reflect the total budget.
And a question I have is do you have any anticipation of, are those other funds outside of the general fund going to continue at that level? Do you anticipate, or are you hearing anything different than that?
Mr. Chair, this is the base funding. So the Ag Fund is the fees for services that come in. We don't yet know what Governor Dayton is going to do with the budget proposals that we've submitted to them. submitted to him, so I guess at this point I don't know what will change as far as any of those other any of the proposals we might have that would affect this division.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we applied for and received some competitive funding from FDA to develop a rapid response team for foodborne illness outbreaks 2.5 years ago, and that particular grant is going to expire in July of this year, and it's unclear whether that funding will continue.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that answers part of my question. I was going to ask you what your expectations were for the federal portion of your budget.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the funding for the Food Safety Modernization Act is really up in the air at the federal level, and so we really won't know what that means for our state for probably a long time to come. So we really, the only thing that we do generally get each year, in addition to that temporary rapid response team funding, is about $400,000 to do inspections for FDA in manufactured food facilities. And so that's on a contract basis. And that is negotiated every 2 years.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, I can't. My eyes aren't very good because I'm getting old, but it looks to me like that's $3.13 million or something. That's mostly stable then? Did I understand that?
Dr. Kasten.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, part of that federal funds also is the Equal to Meat Inspection Program. The federal government will pay for half of the program. So half of that is, and that's about $1 million roughly for each year that it costs to run that program. That's the half total. So it's about $2 million a year total, of which the feds pay half of that.
Thank you.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see that it's a small percent of your budget, but I'm wondering if you can tell me what compromises the miscellaneous and special revenue. Where does that come from?
Because they won't let you charge it. Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, the miscellaneous and special revenue is really mostly just transfers in and out of that program with other interactions with other divisions and other divisions in the agency and also other agencies as well. For the most part, that's what it is, and I'd be happy to follow up with you on specific programs that fall under there.
Thank you. That'd be great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can follow up on that, too. One example is the venison program, where we do the testing for the venison to look for lead. So that's part of that, and that's I don't know how much that is, but that is a fair portion of that amount.
Thank you.
Mr. Knopf and I have been talking a little bit about this. Greg, would you tell the rest of the panel here?
Well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, it might be good, too, for Dr. Kassenberg to just clarify this for us. I remember when the meat inspection program took effect in the state. That wasn't that long ago. One of the issues was we basically had to use general fund for the state's match. There's no opportunity to charge a fee for that. So it basically, if the feds are going to put in $1 million, the state puts in $1 million, that has to be general fund, as I recall it, and I wanted to make sure that it was still the same, that case.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. It has to be general funds. That it's a requirement by USDA.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Stumpf?
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, if the $10.5 million is just general fund, both state and federal, what portion, or not portion of that, but what do fees comprise over and above that?
That's a good question. Ms. Cheney?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stuff, the agriculture fund, which is the dark blue portion of the pie graph, that is the ag fund. So that total biennial base budget number, I screwed up. It's a typo in my – I just accidentally reprinted the general fund. So $8.7 million is the ag fund, and $10.5 million is the general fund.
Okay.
And the ag fund is the fees that we collect.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can add a little bit and give a little more detail on the fee structure and which programs charge fees and which do not.
Would that be,
The feed program is almost 100% fee-based, and so that goes in the agricultural fund. Our dairy program is about half general fund, half fees that are paid per hundredweight of product produced by the processors. And then for food facilities, we charge a fee, a licensing fee, that is based on their gross annual sales. All that goes into the general fund, so we do not see that. So any of those fees go back into the general fund. And then we're appropriated a certain amount each year, each biennium.
Okay, so you're getting from the general fund and you're recovering also back to?
That is correct.
Okay. Okay.
Mr. Chair, next I'd like to introduce Geir Friso. He is the director for our Plant Protection Division.
Hello there, Mr. Friso. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. And please introduce yourself for the table.
Yes, I'm Geir Friso. I'm the director of the Plant Protection Division, and appreciate the opportunity to be here today and tell you a little bit about my division, Plant Protection. And plant protection is, we divide it up into six basic units. There's the fruit and vegetable and grain unit, seed and noxious weeds, nursery inspection and export certification, pest detection and response, pest suppression and biocontrol, and then potato inspection. The fruit and vegetable grain, we have a grain licensing portion to that, and that's basically intended to provide bonding protection for farmers or growers that are storing grain, or also requires bonds for people who sell grain. There's also a wholesale dealer license, and this is a similar sort of a bonding protection. Again, this is protection for producers and growers for products that are sold or delivered or contracted. And then the third portion of this unit is the fruit and vegetable inspection, and these are inspections that we provide under USDA agreement. And basically what we do is certify the grades for a particular commodity. So if you have a wholesaler, for example, that's buying a load of melons or strawberries or something like that, they would employ us to grade that produce, and that's how part of the payment is made to that producer. And then finally, they also provide food safety audits. A number of restaurants, Subway and Chipotle and so forth, are beginning to require food safety audits when they buy locally grown produce, tomatoes or lettuce or something like that. And so we provide inspections either on the farming, the distribution, or the packaging aspects. And with those inspections, they are able to enter into a contract with those restaurants. We have a seed and noxious weed unit. The seed unit primarily ensures that the seed labels that farmers and growers and buy, that the labels are accurate and they're correct and they're consistent. We take a number of samples every year, a few thousand samples. We verify seed germination or the viability of the seed. We check the purity of the seed packages and also the genetic identity. And finally, we assist counties with implementation of the noxious weed law. Our nursery and inspection and export certification program, we inspect and certify about 2,500 nursery dealers and growers. We issue about 3,500 export certificates for shipments to over 70 countries. And China and Canada by far are the biggest buyers of Minnesota commodities. And interestingly enough, in the case of China, there's been almost a five-fold increase in the number of FIDOs that we issue in just 1 year from commodities going from Minnesota to China. So they're a huge trade partner right now. And we also inspect and certify migratory apiaries. A lot of beekeepers take their bees to California to pollinate almonds and things like that, and they have to have a certificate about, as that they're disease-free. And then we administer a wolf-elk compensation program that compensates cattlemen and farmers from loss or damage caused by wolf or elk.
Mr. Friesel, is that what's the status of that fund now? Is that depleted, or do you have how is that working? Are you able to get enough funds to pay the claims? Or
Mr. Chair, members, we were severely challenged about a year ago, not only from wolf claims, but also there was a big uptick in elk claims. Since that time, those herds have been downsized a little bit. And we also, from the wolf side, we were able to get an additional $100,000 grant from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So with that additional $100,000, we're in pretty good shape with that fund.
Thank you. Senator Kelash?
I'd just like to go back a little bit on the food safety audits that you're providing for some of these customers. Can you is that a growing part of the your division? And what does that include, I guess?
Mr. Chair, Senator, this is a growing interest. Years ago, we would maybe do one or two or three a year, and what's happening is that a number of these restaurants want to have some assurance about how the food was produced, whether it be how it's handled or packaged or certain sanitation practices. And there's six basic components that they can sign up for, and it's the grower has to pay for the service, and it's by an hourly rate. But once they become certified in this audit, they have basically an in with this restaurant chain.
Is that also for grocery stores, or?
There are a few. Walmart, I think, is one that has contracted with us in the past. So I'm not so sure about supermarkets, but
okay. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Friesel, are you at some point going to go through the labeling of organic and how that goes about and how you certify that it is can be used as an organic?
Yeah.
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the organic certification is actually part of a different division, so I won't be covering that.
Right. Senator Stump.
thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the licensing provision, have the dollar amounts for bonds adjusted for the grain prices? And how many, or if any, bondholders would have gone under, or facilities that handle grain?
Mr. Friesel?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's actually a very good question, one that's we are very concerned about it. We do have some potential proposals to address it. There has been the bonds are typically at set at 50% of storage for a month, so every situation is different. Sometimes some of the growers maybe receive partial payment or something like that, but there are oftentimes shortfalls where growers may only get a portion of their money back on the. Right now, also, I think it maxes out at $500,000. So, and obviously, there's much larger storage facilities than that.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Friesel, could you mention if there's any that have gone bankrupt?
Mr. Friesel?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, there have been some bankruptcies in the past. And we do have a few in the pipeline that we're working with right now. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, our pest response, detection and response. This is basically the unit that deals with kind of sort of the new pests that seem to show up all the time. This is sort of our regulatory portion. We deal with things like potato cyst nematode. Every year we look for carnal bunt. We never find carnal bunt, fortunately, because we don't find carnal bunt, that allows us to sell wheat in Europe and Asia. We look for soybean cyst nematode. Probably half of the counties in Minnesota are infested with soybean cyst, but the other counties that are not infested, that opens up some export opportunities for them. And then, of course, emerald ash borer is a huge one for us. In fact, I don't know if the members are interested, but I brought some souvenir emerald ash borers. If you'd like one, I can pass those around. People are often surprised that the Department of Agriculture has anything to do with forest pests, but that is really because at both the state and the federal level, it's the regulatory or the quarantine authorities typically rests with the Department of Agriculture, whereas the management sort of long-term strategy containment is switches over to the DNRs and the Forest Service. So we are sort of the first line of defense, and then it switches over to DNR, and that's why we are so involved with emerald ash borer, and we receive about $1 million in funding from USDA APHIS for our work with emerald ash borer. And then I showed a picture. There's a burning fire there. Dr. Hartman and Dr. Kassenberg always get to show pictures of burning animals. I wanted to show a picture of us burning some plants. These are geraniums. They came to Minnesota. There's 27 nurseries. They brought geraniums from Kenya. And these geraniums were infected with a bacterial blight called Ralstonia. And Ralstonia does not exist in the United States. And you may not care much about geraniums, but Ralstonia is also a very serious bacterial disease on potatoes, and that's why we wanted to destroy these plants. So there was, I think, 25 nurseries that we pulled all the geraniums, and then we had to have our inspectors much enjoyed setting some fires to burn all these plants. A potato cyst nematode, this is one we've been very concerned about. Potato cyst nematode was found in New York back in the early 40s, and it never moved out of that quarantine area until just a few years ago. It was found in Idaho. And we were very concerned that it might be found in Minnesota. So over the years, we've pulled over 10,000 soil samples and covered over 58,000 acres of potato fields. And we're very fortunate in that we have not found any potato cyst nematode. 2 years ago, we became especially concerned because we learned that the province of Alberta, Canada, which is a large seed potato producer, was actually found to be positive with potato cyst nematode. And doing some trace forwards, we did find some of those potatoes. Seed potatoes came to Minnesota, so we of course, followed up with some intensive sampling. Okay, this is not a slide of me starting at the Department of Agriculture, but I did want to illustrate that the plant protection statutes in Minnesota are actually quite old. They go back to the 1919 is the earliest on the. This is an old joint USDA Department of Agriculture inspection for barberry, and barberry is the alternate host for black stem rust in wheat. And it's interesting because as old as that program is, it still goes on today because black stem rust, it's a fungus, and it mutates all the time. So you have to keep looking for susceptible varieties of barberry, which is the alternate host. And so we monitor for both the rust spores, and we also check barberry plants, and especially in the nursery trade. So old program. Then we have a potato inspection unit. They are primarily officed in East Grand Forks. We certify all the seed potatoes that are grown in Minnesota, which is about 8,500 acres. We do about 2,000 shipping point inspections, and then we do about 8 to 9 million hundredweight of processing inspections, and these are at the processing plants where we grade the potatoes coming in.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been some discussion about combining the certified seed potato
portion with North Dakota. Are you aware? Is there any progress or any more discussions with that?
Mr. Friso?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I know that's been discussed. I've heard it for several years, but it's never really seemed to have gotten much traction. That said, there is quite a bit of cooperation. We share the extension agent from North Dakota State is typically shared with the University of Minnesota, the potato specialist. So there is already in place a lot of cooperation and back and forth, but not as they haven't gotten so far as having a single certifying. And of course, in North Dakota, I believe they have a seed department rather than a.
Senator Scoyne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would encourage it with the declining number of acres. It's harder and harder to keep a viable program. And there's absolutely no reason that shouldn't be run as one unit between the two states.
Could you, I'd have a question just how many acres of, where do we source our seed potato at and what percentage of our crop is sourced from other seed crop is, our needs are sourced from other areas? Do you have any idea about that?
Are you asking how many, where Minnesota seed potatoes go?
Yeah, how much of our seed we're bringing in from other areas? Are we growing like 20% of the seed we need here or 30 or?
Mr. Chair, I'd say it's a pretty fairly high number of seed that we grow for Minnesota. There is some export to Canada. Probably more comes into to Minnesota than goes out. But as to Senator Scoey's point, the seed potato acres in Minnesota is going down every year, so it is becoming tougher to support that program. So I there's some value in taking a look at that.
Thanks.
Then the last one I just wanted to mention was the unit that deals with pest suppression and biocontrol. This is basically our gypsy moth program. We set about 20,000 traps every year. Last year we treated about 98,000 acres with pheromone flakes, and this is primarily on the North Shore. And most of this funding comes from USDA APHIS and USDA Forest Service. Then we also do biological control. We spend a lot of time trying to come up with some control measures for emerald ash borer. We did get a permit to release some stingless wasps, so we released about 2,000 stingless wasps down in Houston County on some of the infested items there. And then we hope to release some of these biocontrol agents in the Minneapolis area where there's along the bluffs which are almost impossible to get to remove those trees. And we've also released some fungal agents against gypsy moth and then some weed targets, principally leafy spurge, spotted knapweed, and pansy mustard. And then for our budget, we are about a $14.5 million division. We have 70.49 FTEs. General fund is $4.26 million. Our fees that we generate are about $7 million, and then we get about $3 million in federal grants. And then at the very top, there's a heritage fund. That was one-time funding, and that was intended to help with the invasive species emerald ash borer situation. So,
Mr. Friso, do you get any support from the commodity groups?
Mr. Chair, we don't get financial support.
Financial
no.
support.
No.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Further questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like now to introduce Greg Bezicki, who is the Division Director for our Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division.
Welcome. Greg, how are you doing today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, and I look forward to testifying today. And, Mr. Chair and committee members, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them during my presentation or at the end or separately, if you'd like.
Okay. Please announce yourself for the tape and jump into it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Greg Bozicki. I'm the Division Director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division at the Department of Agriculture. And up until relatively recently, I would say the title of our division is what we do. We regulate pesticides and fertilizers. It's much more than just regulation, however. We deal with a lot of information, education, non-regulatory programs. And when I say up until recently, relatively recently, with the passage of the Legacy Act, the constitutional amendment, we've been much more involved in all kinds of environmental issues. So we have a significant amount, not all in the department, but a significant amount of clean water money that flows through. So my purpose today is to describe a little bit about what we do and who we are and talk a little bit about some of our programs. I realize the budget detail will come later. Suffice it to say that we have a lot of activities going on, and if I can answer questions, I'd be happy to. If I can't, I'll get you the answer. I'll start with our regulatory responsibilities. One of the key components to regulating pesticides and fertilizers is to provide information and inform and educate on the front end prior to actually dealing with regulatory compliance and enforcement issues. So we have a lot of our activity is actually to try to outreach on our regulatory programs. As part of our regulatory programs, we conduct a large number of inspections. We focus on facilities, but there's all kinds of inspections that we carry out. And we also investigate misuse. And when we, and one of the other programs that has been long ongoing since the Clean Water, or since the Groundwater Protection Act back in 89, is we have responsibilities to deal with emergencies and long-term contamination, so we do cleanups. Whether it's because of an alleged misuse or a failed inspection or a violation of the law that results in contamination, we also do enforcement, and sometimes that is controversial, but it's very necessary, we believe, to have a firm but fair enforcement and regulatory program. Our non-regulatory programs take us into a little bit of a different direction. We're very much technically and scientifically oriented. Since 1985, we've been monitoring groundwater for pesticides. And since 1991, we've been monitoring surface water for pesticides. We also look for nutrients when we do such monitoring. We promote best management practices, and there's a process in which best management practices are actually officially adopted by the state, and we work with the university, industry experts, environmentalists to develop those best management practices. They need to be economically and environmentally sound. So they're not pie in the sky. They're practical best management practices. We like to think of it as a menu which growers can choose from. As I mentioned, we administer the Clean Water Research Funds, and I should like to make a statement here. The Clean Water Research Funds, coupled with a program called AFREC, has resulted in about $2 million. Going into this state for production and environmentally sound practice research. In my experience, it's maybe the most exciting time for growers because we're developing really good science in which to guide growers' decisions. So it's a pretty cool thing. One of the other things we do is we collect waste pesticides. We do this in cooperation with counties. As I mentioned, we administer AFREC. That's a 40-cent per ton fee that is jointly administered by major commodity groups and farm organizations and fertilizer organizations. We administer the dollars and provide support, but they do all the decision-making. And finally, we also are responsible for something, developing and implementing something called the Pesticide Management Plan and the Nitrogen Fertilizer Management Plan, both are which policy documents to guide how we respond to pesticide and fertilizer impacts on water quality, and with the idea of preventing them from happening in the first place. Our authority is large.
Mr. Bozicki, we've got a question or two here.
Yeah.
Senator Kelash.
Before you get too far off of that, with your monitoring of groundwater and all of that, where do you overlap with the PCA, the environmental, the DNR, all of the other water monitoring organizations that are being funded by the state and other funds?
Mr. Bozicki.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kelash, thank you for the question. Excellent question. Generally, we don't overlap. We actually cooperate quite closely. We work and share information. We actually use, for example, the PCA's database for publishing some of our data. Okay. There's ground and surface water technical groups as well as mid-level management groups that work together, so we very much know what each other are doing. There's a few exceptions to that. I'll get into those a little bit later. We'll come across it. But in terms of monitoring and monitoring ground and surface water, the agencies know that we do this. If they have data, we actually usually help them advise on how to, for them to get the data, and then we share. So one of the things that I often hear is that there's a lot of overlap. Well, water goes everywhere. There isn't one thing that water doesn't deal with, an agency, an entity, or people. We all need water. A lot of agencies have a very legitimate role in regulating that and working with that. And because of that, for many years, this state, the agencies in this state have worked cooperatively together. We know them, they know us, and we know how to work together. Sometimes we have professional disagreements, but
okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just to continue, this is an overview of our authority. Our main pesticide authority is 18B. Our enforcement authority is actually in 18D. 18C is fertilizer, and 18E is our cleanup fund, our ACRA program. Members, the ACRA program is a program that was developed back in the Groundwater Protection Act. It provides there's a surcharge which people who use pesticide and fertilizer one way or another pay a surcharge. It goes into a dedicated account, and that account is used to reimburse folks who've had contamination, provided they follow the Department of Ag's guidance. They get reimbursement for cleanups 80% of $350,000. I'll talk a little bit about some of the programs later, but suffice it to say that we've cleaned up hundreds and thousands of sites in this state, and that's a huge tribute to all of the people in agriculture who've contributed to this fund and taking that responsibility. Groundwater Protection Act is 103H. We are one of the very few, if not the only, Department of Agriculture that has Superfund authority. We have Superfund authority to make sure that the cleanups actually happen, or that if there's an orphan site or an emergency, we can access those Superfund dollars for pesticides and fertilizers, just like the Pollution Control Agency can. Our federal authority that we administer is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide and Rodenticide Act, also known as FIFRA. We get some federal money for implementation of that. And finally, of course, there's the Clean Water, Land, and Legacy Amendment authority. Who we are? We are a technical group. We are largely scientists. I myself am a soil scientist from way back. That's wonderful working with these talented groups of people, hydrologists, agronomists, people who've worked in industry, people who've worked for consulting firms. It's a very technical, scientifically directed or scientifically oriented group of individuals.
Most of us are in St. Paul. About 30% are located in greater Minnesota. These are mostly inspectors and hydrologists, where they do most of their work. However, I would say that while 70% are in St. Paul, a large majority of those 70% actually spend a lot of time traveling to sites and getting out into greater Minnesota. But most of their work is in St. Paul. And finally, I would mention that even though this is the Agriculture Committee and I am a member of the Department of Agriculture, our work goes much beyond the crop fields. We do an awful lot of work in urban areas, in urban environments, whether it's in the metropolitan area or in small towns. Our next slide will show some of the programs some of the things that we do, activities, and one of the things we do is we register pesticide products. There's about 12,000 products that are registered in the state, and while the vast majority of them, amount of the product that is used in the state is agricultural, the vast majority of the actual products that we register are not non-agriculture. They're used in urban environments, they're used in hospitals, they're used in cafeterias. I venture to guess that there's very few places you can go where pesticide products are not being used safely to maintain a standard of living that we've become accustomed to. Some of the activities that we have, in addition to the pesticide registration, we register 3,500 fertilizer products. We license a large number of folks, 6,000 commercial applicators, 3,200 non-commercial applicators. We certify 17,000 growers for their private pesticide certification. We license over 300 commercial manure applicators, and we issue about 1,800 fertilizer licenses. So we do an awful lot of licensing, and to do that, we conduct training, and we conduct workshops, and we test the applicators. We're involved in anhydrous ammonia regulation, which is probably the most dangerous material that we deal with on a regular basis. About a third of our emergency incidents occur due to anhydrous ammonia. And unfortunately, in 2009, we had 4 deaths. Anhydrous ammonia is very dangerous stuff. And as seriously as we take our regulations, we are always dealing, it appears, with anhydrous ammonia. We deal with about...
Mr. Buzicki, we've got another question. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Buzicki, can you just explain a little historical background as far as the applicators and their licensing, how long that license is for, and what their fee is, and the last time we raised their fee, and just a little bit what they go through as far as training and education?
Mr. Buzicki?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, there's a variety of licenses that we issue. Private pesticide applicator license, for example, it's actually not a license, it's a certificate. Those are viable for, those are 3 years. To maintain your private pesticide applicator certification, you either have to take an open book test or attend a workshop. Those are done in conjunction with the University of Minnesota. There's a number of other licenses, such as commercial and non-commercial. I believe those are annual licenses. Those are once an individual passes an initial test, which are closed book, they can maintain that license through taking some workshops. That's kind of an overview, so there's different types. I'd be happy to get you all the details on all the different types later, but that's a sampling.
Mr. Chair.
Senator
Rosen. Mr. Buzicki, and the fees.
And the fees? Would be, I don't have that.
Oh, you don't have that information?
Right. I don't have that right here, but I can get that for you.
Okay.
Or if I dig, I probably have it in my briefcase. But.
Senator Kelech.
But I'd be happy to get the committee all of that information.
For us non-farm folks, Mr. Chair, the anhydrous ammonia, if it's that dangerous, I would really like a scientific explanation of why we're using it and what it's for.
Mr. Chair, Senator, anhydrous ammonia is a pressurized gas. It is transported under pressure in liquid. It is NH3, so it's a very simple molecule, and it is dangerous because it is without water. That's at the anhydrous part. As soon as it is exposed to any environment with water, it clings to it. It likes water a lot. Mm-hmm. So if you apply it to soil, if you knife it into the soil, and there's any moisture, and by me, when I say any moisture, I mean, to a layperson, it can be dry as can be, but there still is moisture there. It automatically clings to the water molecules. It stays in the soil, and it is available for the crop, so it's a nitrogen source. However, if it is exposed to the air, it'll move in a cloud. It'll vaporize. It'll move in a cloud. And as soon as it hits something with water in it, it will cling. We are 98% water. If we breathe it, our lungs are burned. If it impacts your skin, you have a dermal burn. That's why it's very dangerous. We have quite a rigorous inspection and an enforcement program. We'd like to be even more rigorous than we are. Resources prevent that. I would venture to guess that if you talk with a lot of growers and a lot of applicators, they will quickly tell you that they really hate working with the material because it's so dangerous. Everyone who works around it is very, very careful all the time. But it is also a very inexpensive, easily movable source of nitrogen fertilizer.
Thank you.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you. And just briefly to add on to that, because it attaches to moisture, when you use it in your fall application, it's there in the spring where other types of nitrogen tend to nitrify and turn into nitrogen gas.
Thank you.
Very good.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just to continue, just a few touchstones with our cleanup program. We have with our emergency response program, we deal with about 70 emergencies each year, pesticide and fertilizer. We've responded to over 5,000 in the last 20 years. We have about 600 ag chem facility, or I'm sorry, contamination sites that we've closed, and we currently have 100 that we're working on to clean up. We've had 9 Superfund sites over the years. So we have 5 active and 4 closed. On an annual basis, we deal with about 150 enforcement actions of all types. About 50% of those are pesticides, and 50% of those are fertilizer. And interestingly, about 17% of our enforcement actions actually come from originate in outer in other states. On our non-regulatory side, we deal with ground and surface water. As I've mentioned, this past year we pulled 570 groundwater samples for pesticide analysis and over 1,000 water quality samples, surface water quality samples. I mentioned the pesticide and fertilizer management plan, work that we do to prevent ground and surface water contamination. Our waste pesticide program, which we work cooperatively with many counties, has been an excellent program. We've picked up over 4.6 million pounds of waste pesticides since 1990. That's 4.6 million pounds of pesticides that are not available for spillage or for movement into our ground and surface water. The ACRA program provides reimbursement, has provided over $30 million in reimbursement, provides about $1.5 to $2 million in reimbursement each year. And our AFREC program, the fertilizer research program, is funded to the tune of about $800,000. We also
Miller, Senator Miller's got a question. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Senator Kelash's earlier question on water, you're talking a lot about monitoring water, and you talk about collaborating with other agencies. Is there, in your opinion, is there an opportunity to consolidate some of those responsibilities with other agencies? So instead of multiple agencies stopping maybe where they're doing some testing on water because another agency picks it up, is there some consolidation opportunity there?
Mr. Buzicki.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, yes, there's, we call it collaboration. So when you look across our programs, for example, we have soil and water conservation districts maybe in the best position to actually pick up a sample if they're properly trained. So we work with locals even. We consolidate, we work jointly. PCA will pick up samples from wells that we're interested in, and we will run the analysis. They will just simply pick them up according to our specifications and so forth. So there's actually work groups that exchange on a regular basis emails and things as to who's going where. So when you talk about consolidation, whether that's going to take place in one agency or whether that just takes place across the Internet so that people can work together, that's actually been going on for some time. There's actually quite a bit of that. A lot of it's under the radar screen. It's working, taking place at the staff level, so a lot of people don't hear about it, but it actually happens pretty frequently.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, Senator Miller. In fact, not frequently. It happens all the time, every day.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just to keep moving along, we do a number of surveys. We do surveys, phone surveys. We work with our ag stats people. We actually do surveys where we sit down with growers at their kitchen table to get information. We get this information because we need to have facts from which to base policy on and to not just go by presumption, but actually have good, sound information that we can learn from. I've mentioned the clean water funding. We can talk a little bit about that down the road, but suffice it to say that we are providing research dollars, providing grants for research dollars. We provide technical support in a variety of ways through demonstration sites, working with local units of government, and providing technical assistance to entities such as the grassroots group doing research to look into preventative practices to protect water quality. One of the things I would like to talk about is is something that's actually taking place today. These are some emerging issues. Some of them have been around for a little bit. But they're, in my estimation, some things that this committee and the state will be dealing with significantly in the future. The first is the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System. I can't even say it, NPDES. This is a federal program that is actually going out for public comment today, but it is the merging of the traditional pesticide regulation with the Clean Water Act. About 2 years ago, EPA, after having lost a case, was directed by the courts to develop a permitting system for the application of pesticides over and near waters. That permitting program, has been developed by the Pollution Control Agency. It is being announced today, coincidentally, for comment. We have been working very closely with the Pollution Control Agency because they do not have experience on pesticides. But this is not just a Minnesota issue. This is taking place nationwide. And by the 9th of April, people who apply pesticides in certain categories, mosquitoes, aquatic pesticide applications, roadside applications, and forest canopy
will have to subscribe to this system in order to get the protections of the general permit. Another issue that is that has just been recently made announced is the University of Minnesota's framework, what's called the framework, and it's a 25-year plan to deal with Minnesota's water, to make water quality and quantity sustainable, and suffice it to say, it has a great impact on agriculture.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Buzicki. Back to the NPDES permit. What's the status of aerial applicators in that process? I heard you say that forest canopy and roadside ditches, et cetera. Do you know the status of aerial applicators?
Mr. Buzicki.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I know the aerial applicators are quite concerned about it. And I think all applicators who are potentially involved in this are concerned, and they want to see how this permit system is unrolled. But if an aerial applicator would be applying mosquito control to an area, for example.
Well, let's use farms because we're the Ag Committee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy. There is an agriculture exemption, so it's not so much, there is an agricultural runoff exemption. The way the permit is being crafted, as my understanding, is that what they're trying to do is target certain types of application. So on the surface, initially, agriculture is not involved. Neither are aerial applicators as an entity. But if they are doing a forest canopy application, where you can imagine that the pesticide could get to a stream underneath the canopy, or a mosquito application, they would not be doing aquatic or roadside, but those are the people that would have to get this permit, fulfill the requirements of the permit, so that they would receive the protection from liability of the permit.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So, Mr. Buzicki, so an ag applicator is applying to a farm field, and he's going to receive the ag exemption, even though when he gets to the end of the field and on his turn to go back, he might be over other lands.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, yes, that would be correct. What we have been talking to EPA and to PCA, and by the way, PCA, this has been a very difficult issue. They've been trying their darndest, and we've been working with them, but they had a big challenge. What we have said is initially when people were talking about this at the national level, these were going to be very extensive. But we made the case, the pesticide regulators in Minnesota and other states said, no, a pesticide applicator, whether it's aerial or ground, their job is to put that material on the target. If it is off target, it is a violation of the law. You do not want to get into a situation where you're permitting violations of the law. So by staying to that policy, if you will, agriculture and aerial application, some of those things were basically said, okay, it's either on target or it's a violation of the law. We're not going to be permitting it. So
okay,
they were moved out of that.
Very good.
Ground and surface water protection, I would venture to say, is we'll be dealing with that for as long as we're here. There is a lot of concern about groundwater contamination from fertilizer and nitrates. It is a very serious issue. We're working on it, but frankly, it's a very challenging issue. Surface water protection, I would make, especially for some of the new members, I would make the case that that we have been, because of our monitoring and the efforts of growers, surface water contamination from pesticides, although it's quite commonly found, tends to be at very low levels in the state. Same with groundwater. Minnesota's got some of the lowest concentrations of ambient pesticides in our groundwater and surface water than most every other state, and that's a real credit to growers. Having said that, the next issue is going to be a real challenge because standards are always changing, and the standard-setting agency for environmental issues is the Pollution Control Agency, And I know that they're in the process of monitoring their standards. And finally, I'd make a point that water, for years, we always heard about very low levels of pesticide analysis analytically. And I pretty much disregarded that because I didn't see the science there, except for some very unusual laboratories like the USGS. We have some equipment now, and I will. We're not ready to talk about it in any detail, but the new generation of equipment can actually we can actually find very low concentrations of pesticides and other materials, very very low levels. The good news is that we'll know they're there. The bad news is that a number of these products can be found in low levels in a number of different places. And finally, I'd make a case that one of the issues that the committee will be hearing more of is bed bugs. You may have heard quite a bit about it already. We are very concerned about it because of the opportunity for pesticide misuse. One of the areas, bed bugs are in Minnesota, as we well know. They're in other states as well. But some of the states where they've been dealing with this problem the longest, the stories that we have heard are of great concern, where folks resort to using pesticides that are labeled for use in farm settings, outdoor settings, and they use them in their houses, and they become toxic residences. So we're very concerned from a standpoint of human health and safety. Currently, we are working with an advisory group. We have staff working on this issue to try to work with some of the communities that have encountered bed bugs in some of the areas to get more and better information out. We work with our structural pesticide applicators, but my guess is that sooner or later it will become even a more widespread problem.
Senator Quigley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Buzicki. I understand that originally DDT was used on bed bugs. What's the active agent that can effectively deal with them today?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kubley, excellent question and comment about DDT. Interestingly, just on the DDT issue, my understanding is that because DDT is actually is legal to be used in other parts of the world, that some of the bed bugs that move here more recently from these other parts of the world have developed a resistance to even DDT. I'm not familiar with the products that are very effective with bed bugs. There is a particular product, and I can't recall the name of it off the top of my head, that has a very restricted use that some states are trying to get labeled in their state and appealing to EPA. I don't know that that's going to happen. But the big problem with bed bugs is that there is not effective pesticide use, and one of the things that actually people have found to be most effective is heat treatment, 130 degrees for 4 hours. The problem with heat treatment is it's very expensive. It's $1,000 per room. So that's out of reach for most people.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to have to move on pretty quickly here if we get to the Board of Health, Board of Animal Health yet today. So finished, Mr. Buzicki?
I'm all done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks very much for your presentation. Welcome, Dr. Hartman. How are you today?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. And I think you're getting a brochure handed out. It's a very brief but a little bit of an introduction to people who don't know the Board of Animal Health on what we do. But I'll give you a little bit more of that as we proceed. Thank you. First of all, thank you very much for your opportunity to provide an overview of the Board of Animal Health. I thought I'd start with a little bit of a historical perspective. And Quinn, if you want to go to the next slide. This is something that occurred in the late 1800s in Minnesota. The Department of Health at the time was having difficulty with a disease in people called glanders, and they had shown that the reason these people were getting it was from handling their horses. And they were having, so they were trying to figure out some way to deal with the disease in horses. And so the Department of Health formed a division called the Veterinary Division of the Department of Health. And as we progressed in time into the early 1900s and we got more and more livestock in Minnesota, the population grew and some of the challenges with diseases of livestock grew. They actually introduced a bill at, in the 1901 that didn't pass to establish a Board of Animal Health. In 1903, that same bill was introduced, and with the support of the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, the Minnesota Livestock Breeders Association, stockyard organizations, and the Department of Health, that bill passed, establishing the Board of Animal Health. And so the statutes that establish the Board of Animal Health are in Chapter 35. Those statutes talk about what the mission of the Board of Animal Health is, and that's to protect the health of our domestic animals. It also establishes a five-member citizen board that directs the activities of the Board of Animal Health, and that board is made up of two veterinarians and three livestock producers. And if you look at the slide behind me, you can see what that board looked like, the board members in 1903, along with the executive director. And then the other picture is 2011, and that is our current board. So for 108 years, we've been working under this situation where we have board direction. Next slide. So what is it that the board really does? The primary function the board has is with diseases of livestock and poultry that are of economic importance to Minnesota. So oftentimes those are diseases that we can't treat with antibiotics or we can't vaccinate away or the vaccinating is too expensive to do. So we look at a national or eradication program or a state control program for the disease. The other one is just what led to the establishment of the board, and that is when a disease that is in animals can be transmitted to people and cause disease in people. And we have some examples of that. Rabies and anthrax are diseases. We have many more of them, but that can cause problems in people. Now the next slide, We don't do this alone. We're not just the Board of Animal Health out there fighting these diseases. We work with oftentimes the livestock industry, the poultry industry. They have to support what we're doing and want what we're doing because it's hard to get anything done without that sort of cooperation. Also, these are national eradication programs frequently, probably the majority of them that we get involved with. So we're actually trying to eliminate this disease from the United States, and in that case, we're dealing directly with USDA a lot in these programs. And then also a host of other state and local agencies that we get involved with. I was impressed with our campaign on TB that we had everybody involved, right down to the county commissioners and people in the local community, the sheriff's office, that sort of thing. So it's important that everybody's rowing in the same direction to get these things done. The next slide. The board is affiliated with two laboratories, so there are two laboratories that we work with. One we fully fund, and that is a laboratory in Wilmer, Minnesota, and that lab does both testing for surveillance and testing for export purposes for the poultry industry. And for instance, they do testing for avian influenza. And that laboratory, as I said, we fully fund, but the building is owned by the University of Minnesota, so it's a cooperative effort for the poultry industry. The other laboratory that we work with is the Minnesota Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. That is a run by the University of Minnesota. It's out on the St. Paul campus of the university. By statute, that laboratory is our official laboratory, but we don't have any direct control over the laboratory, nor do we put any, does the Board of Animal Health put money into it? The state of Minnesota does put some money into it. And that laboratory is the only laboratory in Minnesota that actually does animal autopsies, or what we call necropsies, so that if somebody has a cow die, or worse yet, several cows die and want to know what's going on, they can actually pick one of those animals up, take it to the diagnostic lab, and they can perform an autopsy there. And that's the only place that we can get that done. I wanted to then go into a few of the recent success stories that we've had in Minnesota with animal diseases, and probably one of our biggest success stories was the eradication of pseudorabies, a disease that was affecting pigs. And that happened a while ago. We were declared free here in Minnesota in 2003, but it was about a decade-long fight with this disease. And why was it so important to get rid of? It robbed the pork producers of, there were production losses, there were losses of markets, and lastly, they were spending a ton of money on vaccinating pigs to prevent the disease. So once we eliminated the disease from our commercial swine operations, we no longer had to vaccinate for it, and there were tremendous savings there. So that's one. The next one is avian pneumovirus. Interesting disease. It's a respiratory disease that affects turkeys. Minnesota was just about the only state that had experienced a problem with this. One of the reasons, we're number one turkey producer in the nation. Anyway, we worked with the turkey industry for about 10 years to eliminate this disease. We've recently had a couple of flocks that showed up infected, but for the most part, it's gone. At one time, more than 50% of our turkey flocks were testing positive for this disease. So it's been a real a success story for the turkey industry. The next one is chronic wasting disease. Again, this is a prion disease that affects deer and elk only. It's very similar to BSE in cattle or mad cow disease. It's a nationwide program to try and keep this disease under control. We've found four chronic wasting disease infected herds in Minnesota, and we have eliminated those herds and gotten rid of the disease. Next, we go on to the sheep industry. Yes.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hartman, on the chronic wasting, isn't that in the wild deer herd in Wisconsin? And, is there anything that can be done to keep that from moving west?
Dr. Hartman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, yes, you're right. That is a disease that is endemic in Wisconsin. Endemic meaning that it's prevalent in the wild population of deer in Wisconsin. It is also in Colorado, Wyoming, Kansas area. North Dakota, South Dakota have it in the wild animals. There isn't much that we can do to keep it from spreading. In Wisconsin, they've tried. Their initial strategy was to shoot all the deer. Well, you can't do it. It's just not possible. And then they tried to stop the spread of the disease, but it is continuing to spread in that area, and it is spreading to Minnesota as we speak. DNR does do some surveillance down in the southeastern part of our state to see if it's spread into Minnesota, and so far we haven't detected any.
Thank you.
So on to scrapie and sheep, again, another prion disease that's similar to mad cow disease in cattle. It's a national eradication program. We're trying to eliminate the disease. We've had 62 sheep flocks in Minnesota test positive for the disease, and we work with them to slowly get rid of the disease from their flocks. Have been successful in all 62, and we haven't had any infection in sheep in over a year, so we're heading in the right direction with that.
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Hartman. It's always been a bit bewildering to me. How do those prions multiply? They have no DNA, as I understand. So, what causes them to replicate?
Dr. Hartman?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kubley, they're thought to be abnormal proteins. And so the way they replicate is within the cell. The cell starts producing, instead of producing the normal protein that it would produce that would be useful to the cell, they start forming these abnormal proteins, and eventually the cell dies, and they get these accumulations of this abnormal protein. How the details of how all that happens, I'm not sure, but that's essentially what's going on.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Hartman, so there could be an intercellular genetic source. Is that accurate, or?
Dr. Hartman?
Mr. Chair and Senator Kubley, yes, there is some mechanism within the cell that's causing it to form those abnormal proteins. What that is exactly, I'm not sure. So on to the next disease, and probably our biggest challenge so far in Minnesota for the time that I've been here is bovine tuberculosis. We were free of this disease nationally for 30 years. So back in the 70s, we eliminated this disease from Minnesota. Meanwhile, other states were working on getting rid of it. In 2005, we had a sophisticated surveillance system for the disease where we test cattle or examine cattle at slaughter to see if they have the disease. A slaughter plant in Wisconsin detected a positive animal. They sent that information to us. We, with good trace backs, so animal identification, we would be able to get back to the herd that it came from. We tested the herd. It was infected. And subsequent to that, we found 11 more infected herds that were eliminated as well. The complicating factor for TB for us has been that it had, we also detected it. DNR did some surveillance around where we found TB, and they found it in the white-tailed deer. So it's been a bit of a challenge for both the Board of Animal Health and DNR to eliminate that infection from not only the cattle but from the deer as well. The good news is that we're having a lot of success, and I keep knocking on wood because I hope that continues. We're actively involved in it. If you look at this map, most of Minnesota now is back to TB free, and that little blue area up in the northwestern part of the state is modified accredited advanced. So things are going extremely well. I want to thank all of those who were involved in the TB issue back a few years ago for the resources and authority that you gave us to solve it. I know Senator Stumpf was involved. Senator Scoey authored the bill, and it's been very successful. And it was a good lesson in civics for me because the bill passed unanimously in both the House and the Senate, so there was a lot of support for this program moving on. So we'll hope things keep moving in the same direction. We're not done, though, and I think that's something that we need to remember is we've had good success, but we're still maintaining those two parts of the state. Any livestock that move from one zone to the other has to be done under our control. We have Highway Patrol that's doing stops up there to make sure people are complying with those regulations. We're still testing all those cattle herds in that zone. There's a little under 300 herds that get tested annually to make sure they're negative. The good news is that we haven't found any infection in cattle in over 2 years. And DNR, in their last survey they did in the fall hunting season, they so far have not found any positives there either. So we're definitely headed in the right direction. And then I...
Senator Scoey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hartman, so how many years of bovine TB without any positive test will it be till that area can get back to bovine TB free?
Dr. Hartman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoey, the federal government requires a 2-year waiting period once an area becomes modified, accredited, advanced before it's eligible to be TB-free. So 2 years from October 1st, 2010, we would be eligible. So October 1st of 2012, providing that we don't find any more infection in cattle. As far as the deer go, that doesn't impact our status, but we certainly would have to look at that status if we continued to find a lot of infection in the deer herd. I would just conclude by saying that the reason the Board of Animal Health exists again is to deal with diseases in animals that are of economic importance to Minnesota, and also diseases that can be transmitted to people and cause people to get sick. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
More questions? Thank you very much, Dr. Hartman.
You're welcome.
And thank you personally for your work handling that TB crisis. That was outstanding work you did, Bill, and the people you work with. And we're proud to have you in Minnesota.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
The next meeting, I think we're going to do livestock, aren't we? So next meeting we'll do livestock, and tomorrow all of you are invited to meet with a trade team from China, Chinese delegation at the Department of Ag starting at noon. Room B-144 and B-145.
And, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to coordinate meeting people so that they can come in through the tunnel if you'd like for that to happen.
Well, that'd be great. I think it's going to be a little chilly. Cold wave coming in. If you can come and greet the Chinese delegation, we'd appreciate it a lot. I know I've dealt with a lot of those in my career, and they appreciate a group of people meeting with them. That means a lot to them, more than we really think it does. It really does mean a lot to them. So we'll do that tomorrow, and Thursday we'll talk about livestock. So anything else to come before the committee? Senator,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cheney, give me a little more information about meeting you to walk through the tunnel. Do you have a clue of what kind of time you think that might work best for you, and so I can arrange my schedule around that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoey, I'd be happy to meet people maybe even just at 5 to 12 down by the door. If you walk through the tunnel system towards the Centennial Building, you go down to the ground level or the basement level and come out through the parking lot, the lower level of the parking lot, cross through the parking lot, and then you get to the Department of Ag's door, and I can meet people there at 5 to noon.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, no further business before the Ag and Rural Economies Committee meeting.